high on a mountainside, near the asylum in the ghost town of Jerome, Arizona. You're listening to Jerry and Kathy Wills on Deprogrammed Radio.
You don't know why.
Comments and views expressed on the Jerry Wills Show are those of the people that make them, and do not necessarily reflect those of Jerry Wills, the Jerry Wills Show, or the affiliates or sponsors.
Hello everyone, this is Jerry Wills and welcome to the show. During the first 10 minutes or so of this program, during the first few minutes of the show, we had technical difficulties. However, during that part of the show, I had introduced our guest for this evening, Edmund Marriage. Edmund is the principal of the Patrick Foundation, an independent researcher with a background in investment management, business, and land management. His extensive historical research has revealed a single advanced secular benevolent source for all religions, his Golden Age Project, inspired by the work of Christian and Barbara Joy O'Brien, promotes the recovery of past knowledge in order to resolve many of today's problems. He believes that reestablishing high standards of training and knowledge for all important roles forms a priority in establishing good government and successful social organization and cohesion. We are opening the show with the conversation going towards agriculture and agricultural science, and this is one of his favorite areas to talk about. Here is Edmund Marriage.
Led to agriculture, but anybody who studies agriculture knows that there's about 15 terribly important things that have to be met if you're going to be able to farm, not least of which is to have the fantastic, the founder crops, the wheats, the barleys, the peas, the beans, the vetches, something like 25 founder crops. And our modern research, we find that all those crops, almost without exception, started and arrived in the Levantine corridor between Damascus and Jericho at this date of 9400 BC. And so it's quite clear that somebody really clever had set it up and started it, or restarted it. And this is what is described in great detail. It's described in the Bible, it's described in the books of Enoch, and it's described in the Sumerian Karsag records, which is the account of the so-called gods An, Enki, Enlil, and Ninkarsag. And Ninkarsag was the lady, and she was the governor of the Garden of Eden. And so we've got a fantastic story about our ancestors restarting. Now, whether they where they came from, how advanced they were, how many earlier civilizations had been very advanced, these are the exciting areas which we can now look at. But I'm talking here about a restart of agriculture and civilization at around 9400. Interestingly, a date where we first find the domesticated fig at Gilgal II, not far from Jericho, in the Rift Valley, where there was a very good microclimate at that time, something like 1,000 feet below sea level, and where we get this sudden, quite rapid warming up of the planet. And the warming up had to start at the equator, because something like 40% of the Earth's surface was frozen solid at the end of the Great Younger Dryas Ice Age. And so as it warmed up, then the plants moved north, and so did the people who were there, moved north with the climate. And we find this extraordinary agricultural revolution occurring in the Levantine Corridor. It's where all the early dates are for farming. And in the subsequent 2,000 years, we find that the culture bearers, as they're called, from Karsag, take agriculture around the world to those seven principal sites, which earlier archaeologists have recognized as being centers of agriculture later on. They weren't independent developments. That knowledge was taken around the world over a period of 2,000 years. And all the backup references to that are on Learning from History Part 10, which is the basic material and evidence for my thesis on the Garden of Eden being below Mount Hermon. And what we have there is a south-facing slope, a 1,300 acres of a lake bed which was drained, and that was what was called the Absu. And the Absu can be translated in several ways, either the Lord's water or underground water, the Lord's garden. But the key factor was that they controlled the water table in the Rishaya Basin, or it's sometimes called the Ahia Basin. And controlling the water table was the fundamental principle of growing crops. So even if you've got a plant pot on your windowsill, controlling the level of the water in the plant pot was the whole basis of getting your plant to grow, along with providing lime, which we find at Jericho at this early date, lime plaster and lime production, which is complex. We find rectangular houses, we find observational astronomy, we find fantastic stonework, we find them cutting a great water course at Karsag, which is well over a mile and a half long. And all these features were identified by two guys who I sent out to the Lebanon, to this site, to take photographs and look and survey and see everything. And it was all as described by O'Brien in the books, which he first started on in about 71. And we went out in 2009 and could see everything on the ground that O'Brien described in his first book, The Genius of the Few.
Wow. So what we're talking about here is a restart of agriculture and how they figured out, or did they already know what they were doing?
They must have already known. They must have been very advanced, and a lot of information which I've added to the Learning from History series shows how advanced they were. If we want a simple explanation of our advanced ancestors, we just have to look at the technology involved, first of all, in providing our crops, our domesticated crops, and our domesticated animals, which are quite different from our wild animals and wild crops, in about 10 or even 15 different characteristics. It wasn't a simple mutation that made farming. It wasn't people experimenting over 300 or 400 years and then finding a domesticated crop. They would have starved by that point in time. So the whole package was put in place of rotational farming, of nitrogen-fixing crops, and even something as straightforward as pollination. On the Phaistos disc, you have the story of the Garden of Eden, and you have a beehive. And the first thing you do if you're a farmer is make sure you've got the insects to pollinate your crops.
Wow. So tell me something. They knew what they were doing. They were highly advanced. How is it that they were highly advanced?
Well, what genetic records we have are that everybody on the planet, including Aborigines, far-flung corners of the planet, are all the same species, Homo sapiens sapiens. What we know is that we can trace on the female line, on the mitochondrial DNA, we can trace back to a so-called Eve at about 160,000 BC. But we don't find the first Adam until we get to about 50,000 BC. So that's evidence is produced on the 158 marker on the Y chromosome, which is the male chromosome. So we have a link back to very early early species on the female side. But something happened at 50,000 BC. We suddenly find a single male. Now, all of us, everybody on the planet, you and I and everybody, whoever they are, they're all related to that single male on the M158 marker, which suggests that our ancestors were all branches, if you like, of what we call Homo sapiens sapiens. Cro-Magnon man is another description of that. And Cro-Magnon man we find on the west coast of Europe, the west coast of Africa, up the river valleys from the Atlantic. And there is very strong suggestion that those Cro-Magnon people had settled those areas from a site in the Atlantic, because we have similar stories of ancestors coming from the east in the Americas and coming from the west in Europe. And this takes us to the concept of a very large island on the site of the Azores, which could well have been favorable enough for people to live on during the Younger Dryas Ice Age. And the coral records and sea temperatures during the Younger Dryas Ice Age appear to show that the Azores, or a large island on the site of the Azores, would have been an origin or a refuge, temporary home, if you like, for those people. Where they were going back in time, there were all sorts of clues in South America, we don't want to get too involved in aliens. I think what we're looking at here is a sufficiently sophisticated race who would have been capable of all manner of technical skills, maybe even going backwards and forwards to Mars, but that's stretching the argument further than most people can cope with.
Well, we're going to be going into a break here in just a moment. We have a 5-minute break at the bottom of the hour. And when we come back from that break, I think it would be very interesting to examine what happened to the Earth that caused all of this to happen. There must have been an event. And I think that it would be good if we covered that, maybe explain why they were highly advanced. All right.
Yes, I think that's crucial to the whole debate.
All right, very good. Then we'll be back right after this break, folks. Don't go away. Hello, folks. This is Jerry Wills, and I wanted to take a moment to thank each of you for listening to our show. In case you're wondering, this break will eventually be populated with offers and messages from our sponsors. They and your subscription to Expeditions TV make this show possible. If you have something you want to bring to the millions of people listening each broadcast, contact us for details about how you can have your product on my show and others here on Deprogrammed Radio. You'll reach an interested worldwide audience. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in a few minutes to continue the show. Back, everyone. Thanks for staying with us during the break. We're on with Edmund Marriage with some extraordinary information that I know is going to rock your boat. It certainly has rocked mine and Kathy's. I mean, I was talking to Kathy about this for the past few days, really, before the show, and she was saying, this is like the holy grail of things that I've been trying to find information about. And it's just amazing that we have you here with us, Edmund. Thank you for being here with us this evening. I know it's very late where you are, and it really is good of you to be with us.
I'm delighted to be on the show, and it's just exciting times.
Yes, well, it's exciting times for all of us, all things considered. We were talking at the end of the last half hour about a number of things, about how agriculture really kicked into high gear about 9500 BC. Is that right?
That's right. And suddenly then, arrives. It all the domestication of crops, the domestication of animals, great sophistication, suddenly arrives at 9,400, which coincides with a rapid warming of the Earth following the great Younger Dryas Ice Age in what was regarded as a glacial refuge of all the important agricultural plants, particularly all the seed plants. Some 80 to 90% of all the grasses, seed grasses, which make up our cereals, were in that particular area of the world.
Mm-hmm. So when you and I were talking, one of the things that really blew my mind, you were telling me about a supernova and how this is responsible for so much that led to what you just described to us. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. The books which led me into this were Paul LaViolette's Earth Under Fire, The Cycles of Cosmic Catastrophe by Richard Firestone and his colleagues, also the important book on geology, which was written by Allen and Dallaire, called Cataclysm. And within those three books, we have the evidence of this major event at 10,850 BC, mm-hmm. which was the beginning of the Great Younger Dryas Ice Age. And the planet went into as cold a period as we've had in the previous 100,000 years. During that phase, from 10,850 to the warming up starting 9,500. We also find that particular phase is the boundary between the Clovis and the Fulsom peoples in America. And you have a situation where in New Mexico you would have had people surviving on the tops of the mountains where there was a sufficient sun, but if they were in the valleys, they would have frozen. But being on the tops of the mountains, they were able to see what animals were left and where they were migrating, so they could hunt them for food. You find a very similar situation at Göbekli Tepe, where people would have been able to see their food walking by in the valley below and know where to go to bring home the three meals of the day. And Göbekli Tepe is particularly interesting because it's contemporary with Jericho. It has that incredibly sophisticated stonework and carving and all the hallmarks of the angels and watchers, who are the biblical names we get, and the very clear descriptions in the Bible of who these people were. And we just need to look at the Bible and do some retranslating or correct translating of ancient texts that were passed down over thousands of years. And O'Brien did this, and the starting point is to look at the alternative Genesis on the Golden Age Project website. And you'll get the clues there from O'Brien. He also does a fantastic job at looking and retranslating or improving the translations in the books of Enoch, because Enoch went to meet the great Lord and record all that was going on. Another wonderful story. And then the icing on the cake was the Sumerian records from the archaic, very early Sumerian cuneiform, probably about 3,500 BC, if not earlier, where we get a detailed story of An, Enki, and Enlil, and Ninkarsag, and what was happening at the Garden of Eden site below Mount Hermon, not far from Baalbek. So they started at the Great House at Karsag, and then moved headquarters to Baalbek, And Baalbek was like the home of the gods at the head of the two rivers, which wasn't the Euphrates and Tigris, it was the Litani and the Orontes. But back to the big cataclysm. Firestone makes the point that there was a supernova explosion about 39,000 BC, which flashed heat one side of the planet, which was on the side of Australia. And we find the giant kangaroo being wiped out at that particular time. And following that initial flash, we get a whole series of very rapid swings in the Earth's temperature, making it clearly impossible for life to be carried on as normal, and people having to go into caves to survive. Very big fluctuations in temperature, which I show in the Learning from History series videos, YouTube videos. And then that settles down. Everything quietens right down, settles down after the big incident at 10,850, when all the solid debris, clouds of gas, all the slowest moving objects blast through our solar system. And this is where we get stories of Venus being pushed off course, the planets being pushed off course, Tiamat colliding and creating the asteroid belt. And this was recorded by the Sumerians, and Sitchin makes this point, but it was a record of what had actually happened when this supernova debris blasted through our solar system. And that shaped everything on Earth. And clearly, there are some very good papers showing that it would have been impossible to farm over nearly all the Earth's surface from the time of the first supernova explosion blast, or not blast, but shearing light, if you like, and heat, right through to the slow-moving debris, which included clouds of ice, and also nitrogen, very low temperature, so that the mammoths in Siberia, happily eating grass, 10,850 BC, would have been literally frozen where they stood, which is what we see with the green material still still inside them when their skeletons were frozen.
Yeah, exactly.
Derek Allen believed that there was something like 200 feet of the Earth's surface suddenly went into solid frozen state as a result of being hit by this blast of nitrogen.
Now, this was blast that was coming secondarily to the flash.
Yes.
Okay.
And we get the movement, the Hudson Bay North Pole moved to where the North Pole is now. You've got America, the very large crater in the Hudson Bay area. You've got the evidence of the Carolina Bays, and you've got evidence of massive quantities of water flooding across America and shaping America at that point in time.
And there's evidence of this.
Yes, solid evidence. I've got another. I was sent by Bernard Dallaire, Derek Allen's paperwork and files, which included the work of another top geologist who has studied the Earth's surface across America and has got the marvelous material to support the thesis of the Great Flood, when the oceans sloshed around the whole world as a result of the Earth being tipped on its axis.
Wow.
And one of the most interesting aspects of this was John Gagnon's book, Message from the Ancestors. And what he's saying, and I believe it makes sense, I would like to see more verification and more support for his work, because I believe it's immensely important. And what he's saying is that in the Great Pyramid, this event was encoded in the Great Pyramid. The king's shafts, the shafts from the king's chamber in the Great Pyramid, mm-hmm. pointed to where the Great Pyramid, where when the Great Pyramid was built, those sharps pointed to the North Pole Star and the South Pole Star, the positions they were in at 2,450 BC.
That's different than what they are now.
Yeah, slightly different from what they are now. But okay. The most important thing was that the Queen's Chamber star shafts pointed to where those pole stars were before this 10,850 cataclysm.
So that would make the pyramids much older.
No, it doesn't make the pyramid much older. It makes the knowledge of this event being ingrained amongst the elite right up to the time of the building of the pyramids on the Giza Plateau.
All right, I see.
And remember, there was a big move exactly the same time to convert the observational astronomy henges from being used purely for observational astronomy to being converted into what were called chambered tombs, if you like. Stonehenge was given these fantastic stonework, which clearly was designed to have a very large roof, which would have had accommodation and shelter and would have protected people from what they were worried about was the sky falling. Mm-hmm. On the Giza Plateau, it was a massive program because the Egyptians weren't Egyptians. They were the elite of the Sumerians. Menes was the son of Sargon. And so we have migrations from the Mesopotamian plains to Egypt at 2,800 or so. So the elite, the world elite, arrived in Egypt at that time. And they were responsible for building the mastabas and the great structures, which are called tombs, but they were all shelters for people to take cover from what they thought was going to be another real pasting from outside sources. And in fact, it had arrived at 2,355, according to tree ring analysis. So they had forecast the next great cataclysm, which in fact finished off the city-state system in Sumer at that date of 2,355 BC. So they knew a tremendous amount about observational astronomy, and the elite had recorded the 10,850 event. And these are very, very significant points. Taken along with all the other evidence of advanced technology, quite apart from the incredible farming skills in creating the domesticated crops and domesticated animals, as I said, are quite different from the wild versions. The ability to be able to heat gold to 5,000 degrees centigrade in about 6,000 BC, and I've got the letters from Charles Hapgood to the head of the Atomic Energy Commission in the UK confirming that they knew that. And we can go on and on with incredible skills of our ancestors. And what we find too from Plato and Lao Tzu is that our ancestors were considered to be totally benevolent. Right up to the time of the Romans and the Greeks, you were forbidden to criticize the gods because they were regarded as totally benevolent people who had delivered agriculture and civilization and superb social organization through the city-state system, which, as I said, was completely destroyed or almost. There's still city-state operations working amongst tribal peoples around the world, mm-hmm. but the Sumerian city-states really came to an end. The old order came to an end at about 2,355. We had another catastrophe at 3,127, which was associated with the Kofels incident over the Austrian Alps. That was the end of Uruk. But one of the greatest cities on the Euphrates was at Mari. And that's a very, very important place to start to study how sophisticated the social organization was. with over 200 craft trades and guilds, probably well before 3000 BC. Mari was a contemporary of Uruk, but didn't seem to have quite the same problems that Uruk did, and kept going for longer until it was excavated by a wonderful French archaeologist called Parrot.
Mm-hmm.
And the lady Ninkarsag, whose name was Mari, the Basques called her Mari, she is back to this governor of the Garden of Eden, goddess of irrigation. And her statue was in the center of the administrative buildings in Mari, and she was holding a large bowl out of which a fountain flowed. And she was known as the goddess of irrigation.
And we're calling these gods and goddesses, but were they really gods and goddesses, or were they something else? And there, you know, if you look into the Sitchin material, we're talking about people from out there, extraterrestrials or whatever. But I have a feeling that that's not the case.
Yes, that's right. If you look at the Golden Age Project website, you'll see my paper, which compares Christian O'Brien's work with that of Zechariah Sitchin.
All right.
And Zechariah Sitchin made the point that we are descended from an advanced civilization, which is the key argument we're discussing now. But it's got so distorted, and one of the main reasons for that distortion was a misinterpretation of the Isin texts mm-hmm. by Professor Langdon at Cambridge. And Professor Langdon at Cambridge, in interpreting the Isin texts, put the dates of the first Sumerian kings back to 241,000 years ago, before the flood. and that was totally overturned by the great linguist and specialist called Lieutenant Colonel L.A. Waddell. And if you look at the chronology on the Golden Age Project website, you will see all Waddell's comments and the dates for the Sumerian kings. We don't have Sumerian kings any earlier than 3,360 B.C., so the whole thesis of mining gold in South Africa, the Absu being in South Africa, are all products of the Sitchin work, which cannot be substantiated. The work that Michael Challenger has done is very interesting and very important, but the structures across Southern Africa are agricultural homesteads. Some of them may well have been involved in dealing with gold and smelting gold, but they are typical of agricultural homesteads all over Africa and the Near East. And I've spent time myself on Crescent Island at Naivasha in Kenya, and all the ancient farmsteads, if they had the stones, they'd build circles of stones around the outside of their huts to keep the wild animals out, and also around the outside of their enclosures.
Right.
If they hadn't got stones, they'd use thorns, as the Maasai do today.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a big problem here in confusing the agricultural settlements with some kind of ancient agriculture and gold mining at 2000 or 200,000 BC. There isn't any evidence that I've seen which puts any of those structures earlier than about 7,000 BC. So that's a key point to make, because so many people trust authors who write books, and it can lead you into awful trouble if you get it wrong. And that's why it's so important to verify all the information you get as best you can. We can't all do it. We all make mistakes. We're going to make mistakes. But what we're trying to do is put forward a hypothesis or as many hypotheses as we can to see whether they stand the test of time. And we call it peer review, but the difficulty has always been finding the peers to review subjects.
Yeah, well, that's not the truth. You know, as I'm listening to this and I'm thinking about what you're saying, it must occur to everyone else listening that prior to that brilliant light, that radiation, whatever it was that showed up and hit the Earth, there were people living here at that time, and it sounds like they were pretty highly advanced people. Is that right?
Yes, there's no doubt about that in my mind. I think what we need to look at is what happened when this catastrophe took place. Now, one of the things that must have happened, the Earth's atmosphere must have been stripped off, or a large part of it stripped off. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that we lose all the very large species. For example, I mentioned earlier the giant kangaroo. I can imagine a kangaroo 12 feet high with a big kick. But that's what we see the remains of at about 39,000 BC in Australia. Mm-hmm. We see the giant camels, we see the giant sloths, the saber-toothed tiger, the mammoths, and an incredible number of species go extinct at that boundary of 10,850. Now, the logic is this. If we had a much denser atmosphere, which we clearly did, then people, humans living in that atmosphere, dense atmosphere, would have been quite a lot taller and would have lived longer. Now, the basis for that statement is experiments on fish in tanks where the atmospheric pressure has been increased, and we find that they grow to twice the size and live twice as long. That's reliable research, as I understand it. And that would explain all the very large skeletons that we find all around the world. You can't ignore them. They're everywhere. Mm-hmm. Are very tall people. And, of course, the biblical records, which talk about tall people and giants. This is something which you have to take seriously, bearing in mind all the evidence we now have and all the bones we have to prove it. There's no way that anybody's going to start producing fossilized bones of giant size. It's not something that's done easily.
No, not at all.
To plant that evidence is nonsense, so we have to accept it. And we're told that Gilgamesh was something like 14 foot high, Enkidu was something like 14 foot high, and we find a grave in the Lebanon and bones in the Lebanon, in Greece, in India, China, America, South America, we've got these very large skeletons of clearly a much earlier race, and they look very much as though they're going to be the watchers, the angels and watchers. And angel is a word, angel comes from the word Engeli, which means Lord of the Cultivations. If we look at one of the leading angels called Shemjazer, his job was root cutting. And so when we begin to dig, we find that our priests and politicians have conveniently removed all the evidence that our brilliant ancestors were excellent farmers.
Wow. And so these folks are the ones who survived not only the flash, but also, I've kind of lost track of the timeline, but they're also the ones that lost, that were left over after the clouds of debris came pouring through. We have another break coming up in about 30 seconds. When we come back, let's go a little bit deeper into the angels, the Anunnaki, Nibiru, and what you know about that. And we're also going to attempt to open the phone lines. There's a little glitch on one of the computers here. It's untested until tonight. So if we don't get any callers, I'm sure we'll get it worked out, and of course we certainly want to have you back on again, because I know we're just really hitting the tip of the iceberg with this information. And I have questions of my own I want to ask of you too. So we're going into a break right now, and when we come back, we'll approach those subjects. All right, Edmund? All right, very good. We'll be back in just a moment, folks.
Listening to the Jerry Wills Show on Deprogrammed Radio.
And hello, everyone. We're coming back for the next hour of the Jerry Wells Show with our special guest, Edmund Marriage. It is really an honor to have you with us, Edmund. It really is. I so appreciate you being here with us this evening.
Well, thank you. It's a great joy for me to be able to talk about what I've been doing for 20 years.
Well, like I said before the break, I think there's a lot for us to talk about, and I don't know that one show is going to do it, so I'd like to have you on again at a future date. We're doing a show once a week, and maybe next month sometime, if you have some free time, we could have you in here visiting with us again.
I'd love to do that, and I think that something I believe is important is this, and very complex, and requires people to forget what they've learned and start again in some respects, then it's got to be taken slowly, step by step. And people can do their own research on these subjects by going to the website, looking at the books I've mentioned, particularly reading the O'Brien books, which the one I would recommend people buy. I know it's expensive, but there's a big postal charge for a book that weighs nearly 2 kilograms, and it's the Shining Ones. And the Shining Ones has everything in it that one needs, and that's the starting point, I think. Now, we did, the Genius of the Few has sold very well. In fact, it's sold out in Europe and the UK, and we won't be printing until later in the year. But The Shining Ones is the book that I'd recommend people to get, because it's about 5 or 6 books in one, and it's information that you can rely on, and that's the important point. You're not going to be pushed off in the wrong direction by reading information that isn't accurate.
And you have a book coming out soon as well, don't you?
I'm writing a book, my first book, which is really a film script.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really the story of Jesus.
Wow.
That's going to be, I think, quite interesting for people to find out that he existed. He was a brilliant man. So important and so genned up that he was appointed the first Pendragon of the Britannic Isle by the Druid Council in Britain. And he was adopted along with his twin brother Thomas by the most important British king at the time of Augustus. And Jesus and Thomas were brought up with Augustus in Rome. The royal families of Britain, the families of the Caesars in Rome, and Herod's link in all this, those three houses were all very important and very closely connected. And Jesus's mother, in fact, was a granddaughter of a lady called Anna, who was the wife of Beli, a very important early British king. So we've actually got a fantastic story about a real live man who was so important to the Romans that they considered that he should be given the status of a Roman god. And we were talking about gods earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Gods were special people. If you can think of gods as being plural and as special people, it all makes sense. And so Augustus was regarded as a god. Tiberius Caesar was regarded as a god. And it was a title. And the family of Jesus, Joseph, Ha-Ramatheo meant exalted of God. So Joseph was exalted of God, and there were three of them in succession, and Ha-Ramatheo, or Arimathea, was a title. So that changes the whole concept of what we've all been led to believe in the Bible and with religion. And we've actually got a fantastic story to tell about one of the greatest peacemakers of all time, who totally united Britain before he went, almost certainly under the guidance of Tiberius and Augustus, to Judea to try and sort out the Judean problem for the Romans. And the Judean problem was arguments about religion. And we've been arguing about religion ever since. And he wasn't successful inasmuch as he didn't resolve the problem on the spot, and it led to the massive problem in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. But large parts of Judea were very peaceful and integrated with Rome. And Augustus is a man famous for Pax Romana. In fact, they called it Pax Augustus. And so if you do your homework on Google and look for Pax Romana, you'll find out of a lot of really interesting things about a very important phase of 200 years of relative peace in Rome, how it started, how well it worked, and how why it was disrupted and why it fell apart, much to the loss of all of us.
Hmm. Wow, that sounds fantastic. Well, I know we're going to have you on for that one. When do you suspect your book will be available?
Well, I've got a good draft now, and I'm about to go off to Colchester and try and do some get some artwork done which recreates the town of Colchester as it would have been when Jesus and Thomas arrived there, when it was a key palace of the British kings early on in the Roman occupation. Claudius built a palace for Cunobelinus, Cymbeline, Jesus in South Wales, and that was, if you like, a refuge from the Roman influence to some extent. So we have two major palaces for the British royal family, and the second one, believe it or not, was built by Claudius when they had a peace on the second invasion of the Romans in AD 43, when Jesus's sons were very much involved, Guderius, Gracticus, Adminius, and his daughters as well. Mm-hmm. And we have a fantastic story. And they all had the links between Romulus and Remus, Brutus and Aeneas. And they all felt they were one family anyway. And the population dynamics being what they are, there weren't that many people around then, and nearly everybody in Britain came from the Eastern Mediterranean. So we all came from the area of Judea and the Lebanon and Syria and Egypt. And that's where, you know, we all come from, right from, in fact, the very start of the restart of agriculture at Carsag, the tribe of Dan in particular, the Danites, the red-haired Phoenicians. We can track everything back to that particular area as a result of the work of our brilliant ancestors.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Nibiru, the Anunnaki. What is this? What do you know about this? Well, we know from what Sitchin has written, but can you set us straight, or is there any setting us straight?
Well, just to start with, O'Brien translates this word as Anunnage, which means the sons of An. An being the senior person in the group, he eventually becomes the god of Abraham. Abraham's god was An.
And where did
the
An?
The Quran is the readings and recitations of An.
Where did An come from?
An is the leader of this group of people who arrive at Carsag in 9400. And the Egyptians' records say that they came from the island of Atlantis. And the island of Atlantis, if you want to see the O'Brien's survey of it and the geological evidence for a large island on the site of the Azores, you'll find that on the Golden Age Project website. It's pretty widely accepted now. The geology and the statement that that was a very important site above sea level around about the time that it was supposed to have collapsed, which was about 9600, quoted by Plato. Mm-hmm. The geology there is very interesting. It's all dealt with on the Golden Age Project website. But that's what the Egyptians say the gods came from. And if you go all over the Americas, you'll find that the gods came from the sea in the east. And so that's another clue that it was a very important refuge during the great Younger Dryas Ice Age for these very civilized and advanced people.
Mm-hmm. So these gods were actually the leftovers, figuratively speaking, of the people who survived the cataclysm. Is that right?
That's right. And the word Elohim is a plural word. We used the word Elohim for our God,
mm-hmm.
but the reality is the Elohim is a plural word. There's not one God, it was gods. There was a monotheistic system inasmuch that An was the leader, mm-hmm. and An was Abraham's God. And we find the Romans giving the title of gods to successful emperors. If you go into the Assyrian room in the British Museum, you'll see the whole wall decorated with the archangels, angels, and watchers, and they're called the Ab-Ka-Lu. If you ask the British Museum, who are these people in these diagrams, they're the Ab-Ka-Lu. They were found in the Assyrian palaces in the most important rooms. And the Assyrians had absolutely no doubt as to who their gods were and who had delivered agriculture and civilization to them. And they were commemorated in the principal rooms of the Assyrian palaces.
And that's
and
why...
They're called Ab-Ka-Lu. Now, Ab-Ka-Lu actually means Ab is either a farmer or father. Ka is an enclosure, rather like a gar, enclosure, garden. And Lu means bright. So what we're talking about when we have the Ab-Ka-Lu described to us were the bright farmers from the enclosure, back to the Garden of Eden.
Back to the people that survived the cataclysm.
Exactly. Now, if we're talking about Nippa or Nibiru, Sitchin talks about the gods going to Nibiru.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sure, but it wasn't a planet. It was Nippa. Nippa was the great administrative center and the base for dedicated to Enlil and Ninkarsag. And it was the main, one of the most important administrative centers in the earliest times. And so when the gods were going to Nippa, they were simply going to meet in council there. Now, what we have is the use of the Enlil or the Enki was the title. So we get very confused because people are given titles. And this gives the continuity of the gods by them having titles. And they had those titles, and those titles were used in Sumeria. And you'll find all the various towns in Sumeria were dedicated to the different individuals. And it was a dedication to the individuals, but there was always a concept that the leaders of the city-states and the communities met regularly in council or met in the great cities to sort out the problems of the world. Now, if we take our druids were going back every year to the homelands of the British people in northern Syria and the Lebanon to have regular meetings to discuss how they should manage the city-state system.
Mm-hmm.
The kings would appoint a king of kings, and this is where Jesus comes in. He was appointed the first Pendragon of the Britannic Isle. Now, in Saxon, the word for king of kings was Bradwald, Greek Ozymandias, and in Sumer, Shishak. So we find in the chronology of kings, we find this word Shishak coming in, which has been causing enormous problems for so many archaeologists and historians. You know, what is it? What does it mean? They had so many titles which they added on. Even Augustus was Octavian, very successful in uniting the Roman Empire, and he was called Augustus as a title. And this is what we find with Enki and Enlil, and those Elion, El Shaddai, these were all titles for the same role in a role society. And they weren't concerned with individuals. They were concerned about how civilization could be run efficiently and smoothly for many thousands of years. So it was a continuity of the various roles. In the most basic concept, there was the Yahweh and Asherah, which meant the leader and his consort. And that applied to almost every small village and every town. And this tradition carries on in what we call a mayor and mayoress. today. And women, of course, had total equality to men and very many important roles. There was no question of women being treated badly in the ancient world. Every talent that they have was fully utilized. If they didn't have children, they were raised to an elevated status. And Muhammad's wife was, of course, a businesswoman who ran a very successful trade business. And that's where Muhammad went to work for her in the first instance. And he had women around him in Medina who played very important roles. And Islam has lots of valuable lessons here. And much of the material in the Quran, it goes back to these early times. It's just a question of interpreting, understanding it, and realizing that it was intended to be benevolent, peaceful, and to provide superb social organization. We weren't intended to wave spears at each other, kill each other, fight each other, and find excuses to have differences and divisions, which is what religion and politics is absolutely brilliant at doing in dividing and creating problems.
Yeah, well, I think we're all pretty familiar with that one. But yeah, it sounds like these folks that we were calling gods, that were called gods, they were people who were highly educated. They were very smart and well organized. And perhaps they were looking at how could we rebuild the way the world was and do it better by incorporating some of these principles that we brought with us from this past and now gone age, and do so by keeping things organized and running well. That's what it's starting to sound like to me. What do you think?
Well, you're spot on, I think, on that one. If you can just visualize what it would have been like to have suffered living on this planet and having to spend most of your time in caves because the worry was the sky falling and all the various associated problems. And this is what we find. We find the most fabulous cave art and carvings going back, you know, and this is tremendously sophisticated art with, oh, goodness knows how many different types of color are used in the cave drawings.
Yeah, I've seen
far more sophisticated than people realize, and they were almost art schools, some of them. We've got so many clues here that life was incredibly difficult. This was a great this is a great time for humans to say, what's life all about? You know, how are we going to get through this, and how are we going to create a social system where we don't have the problems we've had in the past?
And they must have had their problems. I mean, every civilization does.
Yes.
And, you know, you were talking about the Earth and the atmosphere being ripped away by these events. I've had my own theory about Mars, that it had an atmosphere and an ocean, and something happened and it ripped it away as well.
Yeah, that's right. We talked about this before, and I sent you that image from the Colorado University.
Yeah, that's an amazing image.
With its seas, which I thought was fantastic. I also, you know, featured the Hale Crater, and I just simply took the image of the Hale Crater from the European space, whatever it is, on Mars. And you know, I thought there was very clear evidence of human activity in Hale Crater, but that's an open question. It's an hypothesis. It's worth exploring, I think.
Well, you know, one of the things that we've been led to believe is Mars doesn't have an atmosphere, and yet some of the things that have happened have been, you know, exactly the opposite of that. I mean, they're landing the rovers on there with parachutes. You don't use parachutes when you have no atmosphere.
Well, this is exactly it. And I think it's marsanomaly.com. Mm-hmm. It's a marvelous website to look at a lot of this stuff and the images, which show that Mars has got an atmosphere. It may be what the remains of what was there before. But we know enough about the amount of water on Mars that Mars must have had abundant life at some point in the past.
Sure. And we could go on for a long time with Mars because I have such a fascination with it. The face on Mars, I don't know if you're aware of this, but in South America, there's a place called Marcahuasi. And it's a very high plateau. It's about 13,000 feet. I've been there many times with Kathy. There is like a sarcophagus that's, I don't know, maybe 30 foot, maybe 40 foot long, just carved out of stone. I mean, it's not hollow. It's just a big stone that's been carved in the shape of a person lying down. The face on this is exactly the same as the face on Mars, and it gazes directly skyward, just like the face on Mars does. And I'm sure there are other features on the Earth as well. And I think maybe it's the same people that did it.
Well, if we look at where we've come since Galileo managed to persuade everybody, it took 100 years after he was treated appallingly badly that we all travel around the sun. And we've come, this is just 500 years or so. I think how far we've come in the last 500 years, and what's going to happen in the next 500 or next 1,000 years? How much more information will we have? Things are moving at a pace, and we've got to be very open-minded and receptive and very thorough in our research and work so that we don't still continue with the kind of ignorance that we've been brainwashed into believing over the last 2,000 years.
Now, you were telling me about the, I forgot the name of the valley, but it's where the river had been diverted. And was this where the Garden of Eden was at?
Yes. What they did was they chose almost the perfect site in the Lebanon, below Mount Hermon, where in the Hebrew records they talk about the gods lived near the sons of the god lived near Mount Hermon. But what you have there is this extraordinary lake bed. And this lake bed was drained and used for cultivation. It still is today.
Mm-hmm.
What is the bonus there was that the snowfall on the Lebanon, and in this case the anti-Lebanon mountains or the Hermon range, has been much the same for 10,000 years. And so the snow melt from the Hermon range provided irrigation of the crops for the first 6 months of the year. And this is where we find the Lebanon cedars. And the Lebanon cedars were wonderful trees. And it was this irrigation, if you like, a snow melt irrigation, and in the limestone, the cast limestone, which created all those wonderful trees and provided the opportunity for our ancestors to control the water table in the Rishaya Basin. Now, when we went there, we took photographs and we identified three of the four wells. And we fortunately were given photographs by locals of the whole basin covered in snow.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see the warmer water coming up and water from those four or three well points. And so the story about the Garden of Eden isn't the story of in the Genesis. It's a river that went out of Eden to water the garden and was divided into four rivers. Well, that obviously doesn't make sense. They had to translate this from the cuneiform, and the cuneiform is quite specific with different types of rivers and different uses of water. So what Genesis should have said was the great water course went out of Eden to water the garden, whereby it was parted by sluices into four irrigation channels and wells.
Wow.
And then you have what you've actually got on the ground. And this is, I had a confirmation of this from a Turkish professor who translates the word abzu as underground water. I thought abzu was something to do with father or farmer,
mm-hmm.
The great lord's water. But the Turkish interpretation of the Sumerian, and what he's saying actually is that, as L.A. Waddell did, that we use 100 words today which are Sumerian words. We're so closely linked to the Sumerians. Very important to realize that. And so the text that was used needs to be translated as the great water course which went out of Eden to water the garden. And it's there for you to see and look at.
Amazing.
In the same way that you can see all your gods in the British Museum Assyrian room, you can see the features of the Garden of Eden clearly on the ground, and you can see the site of Enlil's great house overlooking the Rishaya Basin is there.
All right, Edmund, we have to stop for a break. We're going to be back in just about 5 minutes, folks. Don't go away. When we come back, there's a couple things that I had in mind to ask you, Edmund. So we'll be back right after this, all right? Coffee while traveling through far-flung corners of the world, the Amazon jungle, high in the Andes Mountains, and street cafes in major metropolitan settings. The best coffee, and for sure the best cappuccino, is found at the Flatiron Cafe in Jerome, Arizona. But don't take our word for it. Come find out for yourself. The best coffee in the world, the Flatiron Cafe, Jerome, Arizona. By the way, their chocolate fudge brownies are incredible. All right, folks, and we're coming back from our break. We are with Edmund Marriage this evening, and if you've missed any of it, I really feel sorry for you, because you have missed something that has just been absolutely over the top incredible. The information has just been, well, just mind-blowing. So Edmund, thank you for waiting with us through that break.
Fine.
And it's really great to have you with us this evening. We got another half hour to go, and I wanted to ask a couple of questions of you, just about things that we're doing. I don't know if you know much about what Kathy and I do. We look for lost cities in South America, essentially, but we like going all over the world whenever we can, different places. And we make videos about these at expeditions.tv. One of the things that we have been so curious about and have been working towards finding answers to is something called the Magna Fuente Bowl. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
The Magna Fuente Bowl basically has, all right, there we go. Turn it down a little bit. It basically has cuneiform on it. It was found.
Oh yes. The Fuente Bowl. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
The pig dish.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly.
Yes, I've got that on one of the YouTube lectures, and it's got Sumerian cuneiform on it around the rim, and it's clearly evidence of Sumerian activity in South America.
Mm-hmm. And have you ever tried to read what it says there?
No, I haven't got. I haven't felt that I was knowledgeable enough to even attempt, because one of the problems is that most cuneiform specialists start backwards, and they start from the Akkadian, which is 1400 BC, when in reality the cuneiform evolved from a very simple picture writing. And this what made Abraham special is he went right back to the origins of cuneiform in order to be able to translate it properly. And I find that he probably is the only person who's done that. The knowledge comes from people like Professor George Barton, who was actually Reverend Professor at the Bryn Mawr College, the Quaker College in Pennsylvania, who was the leading cuneiform specialist right about 1900. And he published his main book in 1916, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the key point is that there are lots of interpretations, and these are normally subjective personal interpretations, and very few people have gone right back to the picture language and worked from the picture language to see how it changed over time under the direction of professional scribes. That makes translations very difficult. But what I think that we find is that the farmers from Sumer, we find the lady Ninkarseg, she has water troughs for animals with her symbols on them. Beautiful carved water troughs for animals. And they talk about the pig bowl, may well have been a pig bowl, and the way that they operated and thought and knew how important their food supply was. It may say something very nice about pigs on there, I don't know. But it's clear evidence, along with lots of other evidence, of Sumerian activity in the Americas. And I mentioned to you briefly Hyatt and Ruth Verrill, mm-hmm. and their book, which is called America's Ancient Civilizations. And they were the great husband and wife team in the 20s and 30s, and I'm sure you're emulating what they did. And I think that looking at their work and reviewing their work is the most important thing if one's looking at everything in South America, because their work was absolutely incredible. And I mentioned to you, I've got here to publish eventually Ruth Verrill's book, Gods Who Were Men, back to our earlier point. And she has produced a whole range of wonderful drawings showing the very close connections between the old world and the new world, going back, you know, for a very long period of time.
Right. Yeah, we were talking about that, and it is fascinating. I know Kathy has been looking into getting a copy of that book, so I'm sure we'll have it quite soon. She's spot on to getting these things done and getting the books in here as quickly as possible, and then spends days reading and making notes.
Yeah.
Right. So as far as Tiwanaku, Pumapunku, you know, we've been there and we've seen what is unmistakable, that of course it's high technology, and actually in the Tiwanaku area there are hills all around Tiwanaku, and the hills, as it turns out now, are other buildings quite large all across this vast plain. It's the Altiplano. The odd thing, there are two odd things really. One is that these enormous statues have a glaze on them, as though the fire had hit them and just turned the sand into glass. The other odd thing is that there is just feet and feet, dozens, maybe 100 feet. I don't know. I have no idea how deep this is, but it's silt. It looks like it was on the bottom of the ocean, or the ocean went right over the top of it and just deposited all these layers of silt. And so we felt that it was silt that was deposited by the ocean running over it, because you can find the carcass of whales and fish and dolphins and other marine animals up 15,000 feet or so up in the Andes. Go ahead.
This is so interesting, because was it Podansky or Pozansky, I think, did the work on Tiwanaku. He was convinced that it went back to about 15, 16,000 BC. But what he may have been saying, and I've heard many geologists say, is that the upheavals to the Earth's crust were incredible at this 10,850 boundary. We had massive movements in the Earth's crust. Off New Zealand, there was a 50-mile vertical movement attributed to that cataclysm at 10,850. 50-mile vertical movement. We're talking here at Tiwanaku, we're talking about it having been at sea level, because we've got so many species in Lake Titicaca, which are sea-based species, shouldn't be there at all. And so the idea that crustal movement could have occurred at the same time as the catastrophe is a very strong argument. And as you quite rightly say, you've got layers of silt at these very high levels. It all makes sense that this movement was part of this extraordinary upheaval. And the amount of movement, vertical movement, is tiny in comparison to some of the vertical movements which we know about on the planet at the time of the great 10,850 catastrophe. Now, the argument, or the interesting point, is were people building and living, and was there an advanced civilization in that area prior to the uplifting of the Earth's crust at that point, or were the items built later, or is there in fact a mixture of very old and more recent work carried out? Now, all the farming that's done up there, with the sunken gardens and the way in which all the crops were irrigated and all the farming issues, suggests that it was highly productive 1000 BC, in the same way that the Amazon basin was farmed. It was managed and farmed at that point in time. This is what's staggering everybody. Yeah. They knew how to manage the rainforest.
Yeah.
They used the charcoal. They burnt what they had to burn. They made into charcoal, and they mixed the charcoal with the soil and added all the human waste and excrement and animal excrement to produce wonderfully fertile black earth sites.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been said that the agricultural production of South America in those advanced times, 1000 BC, was more than they're producing in America today in terms of food. So we've got a lot to look at there, and a lot to learn from the technology of using, as I say, charcoal mixed with animal waste, human waste, and also in the floating gardens of Mexico, they use the bacteria from the volcanic vents with the human excrement on the floating gardens. And the floating gardens gave this wonderful control of the water table. And they got 7 crocs a year because they had a very warm climate. So that was pretty intensive agriculture and feeding a lot of people. And so there are lots of lessons to be learnt here. The terraces which we find in South America are identical to the terraces you find in the Lebanon. And this links the Lebanon and South America to the technology of the angels and watchers and archangels, the culture bearers. And if we can start thinking of angels as principally lords of a cultivation, it helps a lot in looking at the picture in the right perspective, in my opinion. They were clearly extremely well organized teams of 10, 50, 100, 200. 200 arrived in the days of Jared. There's so much in the Bible about them. As I say, the farming, the actual evidence, hard evidence we have of farming and crops, we find that was spread around from the Lebanon over a period of 2,000 years. And one important point I'd like to raise is that maize pollen was discovered to be dated at 7,500 BC on the southeast side of Mount Hermon in an old lake bed by two of the world's greatest botanists, Dutch botanists called Bottomar and Zeist. Now, when they made that discovery, the establishment rubbished them and put them in disgrace, because how dare they say that maize was produced in the Lebanon at 7,500 BC? That's impossible. But my view is they were absolutely right, and that we find evidence of maize in Egypt and India. Maize was a worldwide crop. And not so long ago, we found that maize, wheat, and barley were being grown on Dartmoor in England. You see, when the first farmers came into Britain to farm, and those farmers came from the Near East and from Sumer and that area.
Wow, fascinating. So these folks that were the survivors, the gods, they traveled out across the planet, basically, to try and help to reestablish a planetary social structure. Is that right? Is that what you think?
Well, this is what, you know, we find that Fuxi, who was the great Chinese ancestor god, and we now know that we've got something like 8,000 BC, we've got a lot happening in China, led by the Shining Ones, because the Shining Ones word simply comes from the word Elohim. We use the word Elohim for our God, but it's really a plural word and should be the gods. Mm-hmm. And Elohim means the bright or shining ones, and that can be interpreted as the very clever bright people, mm-hmm. or the shining ones. And then the shining part comes in because they almost certainly used a refulgent paste on their skins made of maybe powdered gold and myrrh to be able to protect their skin from ultraviolet rays and sun at high altitude, which would have been a problem at that point in time. So you can take it whichever way you want. You can say they were very bright and clever, shining examples, or they did in fact wear a sunblock. And Enoch tells the story where he was terrified of them and was taken to see the great Lord. And the great Lord says, don't worry, let's take Enoch and give him a good wash and scrub and change his clothes and anoint him. And Enoch came out and said, oh, I look just like one of them, and all my fear and trembling left me.
Well, you know,
which is a lovely story from the books of Enoch.
One of the things that we know about from the Mayans is that they used powdered gold to this one that I read about anyway when I was down in central Mexico. It was his thing to go, and this Mayan king to go and put powdered gold all over his body and walk around naked with the powdered gold, everywhere. And then he would eventually wash it off. The next day he would do it again. That sounds a lot like what you're saying.
Well, if you want to protect your skin from sunburn or ultraviolet rays, you have to have some kind of sunblock. And from all the descriptions we have, they knew how to put together a brilliant sunblock, which smelt like myrrh, according to Enoch. Mm-hmm. And so your story is something I've never heard before, but it fits in with the overall picture of the kings and the leaders knowing about these particular tricks. And they were still doing them. They might have been doing them for the right reasons, but they were still doing them many thousands of years later.
Right. Well, and the Teotihuacan was considered to be a place that had been built by the gods, and it was kept sacred for quite a long time during the time of the Mayans, and the Aztecs came in. It changed a bit, but the history of who had built it and who had lived there, it was the gods.
Well, this is exactly the same as the Assyrians and the Greeks and the Romans. They didn't have any doubts at all who the gods were. They knew that the gods had delivered agriculture. In Rome, it was Athena, and Athena was the same person as Ninkarsag. And they knew what it was all about. Hadrian built the Pantheon in Rome, mm-hmm. To honor the gods. And he used this fantastic concrete mixed with pumice, and that building is still standing 2,000 years later.
Right.
They knew who the gods were. There was no problems here. We seem to have lost the plot by not really understanding what our ancestors were talking about, or not looking at the big picture.
Well, then here's...
And being totally immersed in religion and politics, which divide people. And have created massive problems. We should all be looking at the basic, in my opinion, Druid principles. Druidism wasn't a religion. Druidism was a way of doing things, a practice, and goes right back to Karsak through the Tuatha Dé Nann, the people of the god An. And you find that the similarities between Druidism and Buddhism and Hinduism and Sikhism and Islam are all there to be seen. And if only we could learn that we all our religions go back to a single benevolent source, and we've got to tidy them up so that we just get simple messages for people to do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. And that's the basic principle of what it's all about.
Yeah, exactly.
And Confucius managed to, when the master was asked about what the guiding word was, it was reciprocity. So you could sum up, you know, do as you would be done by, into reciprocity as a simple, basic message of how we should be getting on with one another.
Well, I have a couple of questions real quick. We're getting close. Oh, well, it's 8:47, 8:48. We have a couple of questions. One is this. There is a footprint that was found on top of a mountain in Bolivia, and a strata of rock that is known to be at least 1.5 to 7 million years old. I don't know how they date rock, really, but we've seen the footprint, or at least where it was, and Kathy found two more footprints in the same strata of rock that were unknown at the time, and these are human footprints. The one that was sawed out of the strata, I mean, it's now missing. Taken by the Bolivian government. No one knows what happened to it. But we have a footprint. It's at least 1 million years old, maybe older, and it's a perfectly good human footprint in all cases, the one Kathy found as well as the one that's missing. And I'm wondering, you know, how does all this play into the entire scene that we've been talking about this evening?
Well, I do one of my learning from history lectures is, as I call it, art, jewelry, and design in the progress of Homo sapiens sapiens, and I cover this, and I produce images going back about 150,000 BC of human-like people, and I told the story of the Cro-Magnon, which is very distinctly our species, mm-hmm. quite different from the Neanderthal and similar featured people. But we have, if we look at the history of ancient man, we've only got a few cardboard boxes of bones to work it out. We haven't started yet. And I would suggest to you that if we look at the logic of all life on the planet, the idea that man has only been here a short while is wrong. We've got to look back an awful long way, and we'll find that there have been many civilizations in the past which would have been wiped out by these regular cyclical cosmic catastrophes. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that we've had very tall, large men and very large footprints, and some blood of very small footprints.
Yeah.
And we've got a fantastic amount of research to do, and we've got to be open-minded and realize that if you look at all other life forms and how things have developed and how interconnected we are to animal life and plant life, if you look at termites, have got some very nice high-rise blocks of flats in the Australian desert, and they manage to control their climate and grow their food in the basement. Mm-hmm. They're doing a better job than we do in our high-rise cities. So we've got actually so many exciting things to look at and lessons to learn from the past, and we've got to perhaps accept the fact that Michael Cremo's subjects of ancient artifacts has got to be taken seriously and not dismissed.
Right. I agree with you, and I've spoken to Michael Cremo a few times, and I find his work just fascinating, of course. The other thing that I want to ask, which is, you know, I don't know if this is even interesting to you or not, but I did have a friend send me a text message, and since we're not taking any calls, because I didn't get that part done, extraterrestrials, people from other worlds, could it be that they are the remnants of the people who once lived here and left, or are they from some other place and just visiting here? What are your views on this?
My views are that you know, you have to have an open mind. You have to look at the fact that we can now identify bacteria is quite able to travel through space and arrive on our planet and do all sorts of extraordinary things. We're trying to deal with the bacteria which cause tuberculosis in livestock, and it's endemic in the badger population, and we have massive crisis in Britain about TB, which is destroying our livestock farming industry, and we're allowing diseased animals to wander everywhere and not be put out of their misery when they are diseased and spreading the disease, and now spreading through cats and people. We've also got a big scare now on the possibility of rabies in Britain. So we just got to wake up and be aware of all the life forms that can thrive and can replace humans sometimes, and almost certainly have done so in the past. And it is important, I think, for people to realize that the odds of finding intelligent life outside Earth is very, very high. Whether they consider that they found intelligent life if they arrived on our planet is another matter.
Yes, I agree.
But we can't dismiss it. We've got to be realistic and look at, you know, several million years of development, and follow all the things that have happened and all the catastrophes that wiped things out and made things start again.
And I think the important point here, Edmund, is that these catastrophes we're talking about tonight are what we know about. There had got to be others that happened farther back in time than we even know, and those details are completely obfuscated with time. We will never know it.
Yeah. Well, as I said to you when I spoke earlier, I was talking to James Lovelock at the Hay on Wye Festival on Saturday, which was a wonderful experience. And he's still quite convinced, and I believe he's absolutely right, that the Earth is absolutely brilliant at looking after itself. And we may come and go, but the Earth is very capable of creating new civilizations, new species, and handling everything that's thrown at it, because it's done extremely well in the last 7 million years.
Right. Amazing. Well, and you were also saying that everything being connected, communication across the cosmos can be instantaneous. It's not the speed of light. It's something else.
Yes. Yes.
And I believe
that. Yes, that's the Electric Universe and Walt Thornhill. And please, listeners, look at the Thunderbolts Project, and get a good look at what they're all saying and doing, particularly about climate change and what Obama is planning to do, which is to try and reduce CO2 by 30% and spend a fortune, which you haven't got, to do it. And James Lovelock made that very clear on Saturday, that it's a complete waste of time demonizing CO2. CO2 is actually incredibly beneficial to a whole range of species on the planet, mostly plant species.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. Well, I think the whole
thing has no effect on climate change at all. The climate change factors are external. That's a very important point for people to realize. And that's, I deal with that in part one. It was the first thing I dealt with in part one, was the work of Hans Fenmark and Nigel Calder in their book, The Chilling Stars, on how our climate is cyclical, driven by external forces of cosmic rays, magnetic fields, and, of course, now all the knowledge we have of the electric universe.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think it's important to let everyone know that your series is being played, how long is it being played? Next 11 weeks, actually, on deprogrammed radio. So if you folks want to listen to the entire series that is being presented by Edmund Marriage, you can listen for free. Go to deprogrammedradio.com, and you can listen to this. And I guarantee you, Kathy and I started listening to this a few nights ago. I've lost sleep because I can't go to bed. I have to keep going. It's like every few seconds is an aha moment. Absolutely. And that's why I was so excited to have you on as my first guest, because your information is absolutely phenomenal.
Well, some of my friends say they love listening to my work because it sends them to sleep.
So well, there you go. It's the other side of the coin. Well, if I miss much more sleep, it probably will. I've had to get
anyway, thank you for that, because, you know, please send your comments and feedback to me at thegoldenageproject.org.uk. I try and answer every email I get, and think about buying the shining ones. And eventually, later in the year, there'll be more Genius of the Fuse. There is plenty of Path of Light for people to look at if they want to get into the really serious issues of what Jesus was actually teaching. And that's really interesting. And also that links with what we're now beginning to learn about the electric universe and the way in which we can communicate across the universe in a flash, in an instance, and have information come back to us. And we have to consider, are we living in an intelligent and responsive universe? And if so, how can we benefit by learning about that?
Yeah, exactly right. I'm going to be creating a web page within Expeditions TV in the members section, and that information will be there, along with the picture from Mars, showing Mars with an ocean, and other details, so the folks can follow your work, find your website, be in touch with you if they wanted to. And of course, we're going to be in touch with you again, because we're going to have you back on, and we're going to go deeper into all of this. We're getting up to the top of the hour. And about 90 seconds to go. Any closing comments?
No, just thank you very much, Jerry, for putting me on. Kathy as well, for her fantastic research, which, you know, is the backup for you, I'm sure, and it's the backup for me. If it wasn't for other people's, you know, lifetimes of research and work that I've been able to tap into, even people like Preston.
Well, the show's closing out. Everyone, I want to thank you for tuning in. Edmund, please stay on the line. I want to talk to you after we get out of the show closing. Folks, we'll be on again next Monday, so put it on your calendar. We will announce our guest later in the week. Thank you so much, Edmund, and good night, everyone.
Thank you.